Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damon Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, an icon, a legit Canadian music icon, Biff Naked, is on the show. I was starstruck when she agreed to be on the show. Starstruck when she came over to do the show. Starstruck now telling you that she's on the show. She is an amazing person. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you would like to get in touch with me, you can head over to the email address, turnoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com, and send an email. You can also find us on the Facebook, as the kids call it these days, at facebook.com/turnoutapunk. Both of those are answered by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, as illustrated by the fact that Biff Naked is on the show today, Tristan Abraham. Tristan busts his butt for this podcast for nothing. For nothing. Does it for the love of the game. The love of the game. And for that, we love him immensely. I also love him because he's my brother, but I mean, like, you know, it's a whole melange of reasons why I love him. But, you know, the podcast is definitely in there. Thank you, Tristan, for all of that. If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me on various forms of social media at Left4Damien. If you'd like to support the show, the best way to support the show is by telling all your friends, letting everyone know that you enjoy this podcast. And then that's how we spread the word that way. And speaking of support, this show would not be possible without the kind, loving support of the fine folks at Vans, who came on board a couple years ago and said, Damien, don't lose money on this podcast anymore. Just do what you do and let us help you. And that's what I'm doing. You know, they let me book whoever I want. So 1 week it could be someone from L7. 1 week it could be Biff Naked. The next week, who knows? We make up our own rules here, and Vans is very accommodating with that. So I got to say thank you so much to Vans. And also right now, I'm like flying all over the place working on a really cool Turned Out a Punk project that Vans is helping me do, and more information on that in the coming weeks. But yeah, Vans, thank you. what else am I going to say? Thank you so much for doing this for so long. You know, hopefully you stay around forever, but I appreciate that you're here. That's amazing. This has been awesome. That's it for, I think, that stuff. Also, shout out to all the people helping with the Turned Out a Punk Patreon, and shout out to all the people supporting this podcast by spreading the word and giving me positive feedback. And I appreciate all that. Thank you. Thank you so much. Because I get to do things like this. This week on the show, we have Biff, or this episode on the show, we have Biff Naked. Biff Naked is a Canadian music icon. I first became aware of her when My Daddy's Getting Married came out and kind of started making noise in Canadian music as a young person. I fucking loved that video and that song, and Biff kept putting out classic songs. Like, she is someone who is 100% a first ballot Canadian music Hall of Famer. But, you know, to just acknowledge all her pop career, that would be enough. But then we also have this incredible punk rock career before all that, and that's what we're going to be focused on today on the show. Biff Naked is a Canadian pop rock icon, but someone that has always repped punk and hardcore, someone that X'd up. You know, I remember seeing her on Much Music X'd Up, and this is before Avril Lavigne X'd Up, before CM Punk was on TV X'd Up. Like, this was shocking for me as a young straight edge person to see. And then finding out later on about Gorilla and the incredible musical explosion that kind of occurs out of that band in the wake of their breaking up is amazing. We get into all that in the show. I'm excited for this one. It's a brief one, but trust me, it's jam-packed. It is jam-packed with goodness. So I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Here is Biff Naked on Turned Out a Punk. Well, this is awesome. to finally get to talk to you.
Thank you. It's awesome for me. I'm in like the sanctuary of a home.
You're in my house.
Oh my God.
I think this is so cool. My wife, Lauren, who you met downstairs, was beside herself. Like, oh was just
God. As
like,
am I.
I'm well.
I mean, I basically French kissed your dog for like 20 minutes. I intend to do it again.
Well, you are as much of an icon as I've ever had on this show. So
oh, very cool.
It's awesome to get to. And I've wanted to, I think I remember around the time of My Daddy's Getting Married, you were on the new music. Around the video shoot you were talking about. Or maybe it was just after that because you were talking about the video shoot and having to take a cab home covered in cake.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I remember that, too, because there were two versions of the video. You know, in the early days of video making, man, I'm so happy that I was able to make so many videos. And
yeah.
I look back now, it was like, you know, it was serendipity.
Yeah.
You know, it really was. Even though now it's kind of easier because people literally can make great content on their phones.
Mm-hmm.
And back then we had to rely on like huge crews and, you know, real cameras. But man, it was just like, yeah, it was so much fun to do all those videos.
Well, I think even in that interview, maybe you talked about Gorilla Gorilla, or I saw the Gorilla Gorilla video.
Sure.
So I knew there was this punk connection. So I've wanted to talk to you about punk rock.
Yeah.
For over a decade now.
Awesome. Well, over a decade awesome. Now.
So I got to start this off the way I start them all off, okay. Which is, Biff, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yes, absolutely. It was, of course, being interested in music as a kid. Never wanted to be a singer.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
Never. I was in ballet for 13 years. I thought I would be a choreographer until I discovered theater, and then I went into university to be a theater major. My sister was in a Motley Crue. So I knew that. My friends all were into Judas Priest. Then there was, you know, this shift into thrash that mm-hmm. started happening with Metallica. And DRI was actually the first real band that I went to where I was like, this is like a blend of music, of musical styles. I'm into this so hard.
Did they play the Albert?
No, they played at this weird little club, like a community center in St. Boniface.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a really weird show. It was like 1987 or 1988. And from that point, I had met a group of guys and started going to see Agent Orange and mm-hmm. started going to see all the bands at the Wellington and the Royal Albert. And then they asked me if I would fill in for their singer. Now, Gorilla Gorilla wasn't per se, they definitely were not a hardcore band in any way, although that we loved, you know, all types of music. It was kind of like skateboarders
yeah.
that made punk music.
It kind of reminds me of the Big Boys a little bit. Like, it definitely has that kind of like funky.
Yeah, yeah. There was definitely the punk funk, you know, because they were really into like Chili Peppers, Jungle Brothers, Grandmaster Flash,
yeah.
just equally as they were into Dead Kennedys, mm-hmm. Euthanasia, all these things. It was great. It was a wonderful introduction into being in a band for me, because I think that punk rock, the work ethic that is necessary back in the late 80s and early 90s to be in a punk rock band probably is still true today.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, you know, behave like an adult. At all times, you can't get bus fever or van fever too frequently,
mm-hmm.
And you have to sleep alongside, you know, your band brothers in a sleeping bag and be satisfied getting paid in Mickey's Big Mouth, and somehow still get to the next gig and put on a killer show the next day too.
Yeah,
it's not for everyone.
No, it is definitely a kind of grinding, especially I think even then because it's. You know, you didn't have the benefit of necessarily knowing, as we were talking about, what you were walking into.
Oh, most definitely. And even when you would mail in advance, you could mail your handbills to the venue and hope some idiot put them up for you. But it never worked out that
way. Yeah, exactly.
And for me, as a girl, there weren't always a lot of other girls around, unless they were literally there to blow the band. Like, literally, how am I going to be perceived?
Mm.
You know, so that was something I was always really trying to be conscious of and conscientious about. I didn't want to, you know, dress too sexually. I didn't want to give the wrong impression. So I found as an overcompensator, as a vocalist, I would totally, like, have this tomboy routine down. You know, I would have this total shtick down. We didn't have an opportunity to call out audience members that would jump on stage and honk our tits. Literally, that's what we call it. Like, honk, oh, God, honk my tits. I'm going to, you know, give him a knuckle sandwich. Literally, that was the response. Mm-hmm. The show kept going on. Mm-hmm. It's not like we would stop the show and go, I'm offended. It was like, this is like punk rock. Mm-hmm. There's a mosh pit, you know. Everybody hold on to your panties. This is going to, like, I mean, I don't know. It's just so funny. You know, and I look back and I'm proud of those days. I'm proud of always how Gorilla Gorilla handled themselves as a band. And even moving forward, you know, the bands after that. I can't look at it as a time where women, or myself even, weren't respected because I always felt like I worked extra hard, extra hard to gain the respect of, you know, the other bands, particularly that we were playing with. Not just my band, because it's like you become siblings mm-hmm. with your band mm-hmm. people. But yeah, it was, I really, now looking back, I'm really happy that I had that experience and that education.
It's kind of fucked up that you were forced to work so hard to gain these other people's respect.
You know? And you still have to be. And now as I'm older and, you know, I go into different things, like, you know, it's one thing to do like book readings and stuff like that. But even me, if I want to advocate for other artists, I want to go into management. Mm-hmm. You know, I tour manage. You know, I love it. It's not for everyone. But I also know for sure that women need to be a part of that, you know, because it's my nature to be a mom. Mm-hmm. I'm a feeder. You know, I want to feed everybody. And I think that that really is an asset for me as a manager and as a tour manager.
So I guess going back to those early shows, do you remember who opened up for DRI? Would it have been Corpse Vile? Or?
Oh, gosh, maybe. I cannot remember. All I remember is DRI and the fact that I called it hockey. Everything was hockey music to me.
Yeah.
Everything just sounded like hockey music. And I don't know who to blame for that, whether it's like DOA or No Means No, like why I would think that. Even when we were on Lava Records, you know, Sugar Ray was another band on Lava Records, and you can look at their early band stuff, and I'm like, yeah, you guys never really fulfilled your potential as a punk band.
Yeah, Mean Machine is a good song.
It really is. It stands up. There were other songs just like it and even harder that never made it to print or to pressing, of course. You know, and I look at all those other bands, especially on the West Coast, because it was just so different, really, compared to the East Coast and the New York stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, even in Toronto, I'm sure, with BFG and all mm-hmm. these type of bands, it was rough. Like, this is rough. Even yeah. She was talking about Sick of It All and all these other... Rough, man. Rough and tumble. Whereas West Coast was different. It had that little, like... You know, eventually it turned into the Sublimey, like, you know, like it was like everyone was on pot, you know, like when yeah. we moved to Vancouver, it was like close enough to Humboldt County mm-hmm. and the whole skateboarding scene, because there's no snow.
Yeah.
You know, that it was a different vibe. To me, I never smoked pot, but I just felt like all these bands were high all the time.
Yeah.
And therefore, reggae always found the way in, that funk punk, that Southern California thing came in, and punk kind of morphed into that a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, the whole hardcore thing to me, really, I always associated it with the East.
Mm-hmm. But there were like other bands, like I'm trying to think of Personality Crisis, I guess.
Oh, yeah, boy, oh boy, yes. And The Unwanted.
Yeah, The Unwanted.
Oh, absolutely.
And SNFU. Yeah.
Yes, who are still touring. And in fact, Randy from Gorilla Gorilla is in SNFU now.
Awesome.
You know, and that's a whole other story. You know, some of these OGs. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, these are OGs of the Canadian punk scene, or even the North American punk scene, really. And it makes me laugh now because, you know, what else is everybody going to do? People still skateboard. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, well into their... Some of these bands are 60 years old,
yeah.
for God's sake.
Yeah.
You know, there's no retiring.
No. And I think it's sad when you look at, like, you know, you look at England, and I think there's more of a reverence kind of put on the yes. the icons of underground music than here, where
absolutely.
It's very much on to the new or on to the next.
Yes.
And, yeah, you don't like, you know, SNFU, DOA, like, invented touring.
Oh, yeah, and they're still touring. In Europe. And yeah. I mean, yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
What was the difference when you saw, like, I guess from Winnipeg to Vancouver when you guys made out to Vancouver and resettled there?
Well, we flipped a coin And that's really the truth. And I think that we could have been just perfectly happy staying in Winnipeg, like bands like The Unwanted, for example. You know, Raised by Wolves, Pointed Sticks, all these type of bands stay in their towns. But we flipped a coin. It was either Toronto or Vancouver. Vancouver won. And again, proximity to Humboldt County. I'm sure the guys were happier. Plus, they were all skateboarders.
Yeah.
So that was a whole different thing. And it was, it kind of, you know, again, it morphed into the skate punk stuff. But once I got out to Vancouver and developed other friends and made friends in other bands, you know, then all the, like, Screaming Trees and this type of thing started happening. All the chicks from Olympia, there were lots of chick bands, and it was just like, hey, wait a minute, you know, yeah, I really like this stuff, and it's thrash, and, you know, Gorilla started to kind of unravel. But, yeah, it was just really, really cool. Very different sound than the East. You know, the Pacific Northwest was really very specific.
Yeah. It seems like it was a lot more, I don't want to say progressive, but, like, maybe it was in the music. Like, it seems like there was a lot more different elements that were incorporated and stuff.
I think so, too.
Versus out here, where it was, as you're saying, like, pretty... pretty stylized.
And oh, here it was very, like, yeah, it was, like, leather jackets and, like, Dayton's and steel-toe boots. Out there, it started to become literally pot and flannel. Found its way into all the hard music, which was great because, in a way, it kind of created a little bit of a new genre at the time. But then that kind of got, you know, like everything, got diluted and kind of weird. But, yeah, loads of fun, like... It was just really, really great experience.
Is that who Chrome Dog would have played with, like Screaming Trees type bands?
Yes,
is that,
so absolutely, 100%.
Okay.
It was so, it was, you know, I feel badly about Chrome Dog on so many levels because the songwriting, I feel, was really a little bit ahead of its time.
Yeah.
James Yock was the guitar player, and he did a fair amount of the writing. Rich Rock, who eventually played in the Real McKenzies as well, he was the bass player. And it was just like, I think that those guys really were not given enough credit. They were great songwriters. And I think that the band should have continued. You know, but again, things happen. Things self-destruct. It wasn't easy. We did a lot of touring, though, up and down the coast. And so that I can, that I never did with Gorilla. Gorilla was always back and forth Canada. And I mean, like, six times a year, every year.
Oh, the death tour.
Oh, yeah. And with Chrome Dog, it literally was San Diego and back, San Diego and back.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
So when Gorilla was doing the cross Canada runs, who were you playing with in Toronto? Was it with the BFGs and bands like that?
I think that we may have. There was, like, you know, Forgotten Rebels and stuff. But we would also do shows with Mighty Mighty Boss Tones and things like that seemed to work out. We played with Bad Religion, but so did Chrome Dog.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it just kind of started to become, you know, the... Once you're looking at, like, 92, 93 came along, yeah, music became very malleable stylistically and lots of different bands. And also, we're talking about the birth of events like Lollapalooza. You know, in North America, that was, like, very eclectic. So it wasn't starting to become not unheard of to have a real different type of bill.
Yeah. Absolutely. So it's amazing with Gorilla how every single member went on to do something else in the music industry.
Amazing.
It's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Limo is, like, amazing. He has still tours, and those guys are responsible, you know, for half of the bands in California, I swear to God. You know, with Pennywise, and Kent, you know, still works with NoFX.
Yep.
And it's just, like, it's incredible. Even Randy, like, for, like, 5 minutes... I can't remember how it came to be, but for, like, 5 minutes, he was, like, the manager of Green Day.
Green Day, right? Like, at that, like, a really pivotal time.
Yeah, you know? It was just nuts. Like, it was nutty. And then, of course, you know...
And yourself.
And I just kept in my lane, like I always do, doing my solo stuff and trying to slug it out as a chick. You know? So that was a bit of a different path, for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's just that... And I'm just... fiercely proud of all those guys because it's fun to keep up with them and catch up with what they're doing now.
Well, yeah, it's wild to think of, like, any other band in, you know, music history where every single member from, like, a demo tape kind of thing went on to become actual involved in the music industry as careers.
Yeah, you know? So fun.
And Limo, I owe to this day because he got me into the Vans Warped Tour one time.
Amazing.
Yeah, when I was like 14 years old. And so yes. I still see him around.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, and that's I still
who,
thank
that
him.
That is who he is, yes.
He is generous. Definitely cool.
Generous.
Very, very cool. Mm-hmm. And it's... So what was the difference between the scene that Gorilla Gorilla was playing in versus what Chrome Dog would wind up playing in?
Well, you know, I think that, like, the Gorilla Gorilla fellas were, you know, most of their friends were skaters and in other bands. And then Chrome Dog, those guys were, like, rocker guys. You know, it was a totally different thing. And they were, like, you know, hooked up with the L.A. guitar scene. Mm-hmm. And it was just, like, totally two separate scenes altogether. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, I was probably, like, whatever, 21 or 22. Very dramatic times. And, you know, it was like having two boyfriends,
yeah,
basically. And it just kind of didn't work out anymore. And so that was hard. And I remember with Gorilla Gorilla, the last tour we did, I'll never forget it. You know, it was like the last nail in the coffin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, it was devastating. It's like breaking up with, you know, three boyfriends. And it's something that stays with you. But I mean, everyone was done with it. And those guys needed also to move forward,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there's only so much that band could have done unless we had relocated to another city, probably an American city. Now I look at different times and I look at places like Chicago, for example, you know, the birth of Victory Records, mm-hmm. and still a success story.
Mm-hmm.
All the bands that came out of that label and still continue to be, you know, promoted and given life by that label. Each city has its own little champions.
Absolutely.
It's
yeah.
so cool.
Well, I think like you would have been seeing all of it. I think pre-Nirvana mm-hmm. and pre-Green Day and pre-Offspring, things changed after those bands. But like prior to that, like, yeah, everything had such probably unique flavor to it. Like
it was just very interesting.
Yeah.
And again, you know, I have to, you know, look to the East Coast and the bands that were coming out of there, like 24/7 Spies,
mm-hmm.
you know? Guar was out of Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah, yeah.
They're theater majors, these kids. I mean, it was amazing. Perhaps, you know, there's, you know, young people today who are like, who could tell me about all the same types of enthusiastic, passionate scenes in all these cities. But all I can speak to is my lived experience. Mm-hmm. And I just think that, you know, all those bands at the time were doing things that no one had done before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I guess it would also, you'd have a chance to develop.
Absolutely.
Like now it just seems like once you get to a certain stage, the world's going to be noticing what you're doing.
It's so different now. It's so funny. I mean, I remember Jello Biafra from Alternative Tentacles sent me a rejection letter.
Really?
Yeah. And it was to the, I think it was to the Biff Nakeds? Or I think it was to the Biff Nakeds. And I framed it on my wall. I'll take a picture. Do I have it at home? Yeah, I do.
Oh,
and I'll take a picture
awesome.
And send it to you.
I'd love to see that.
And it was like, keep doing what you're doing. And maybe, you know, someday you can put out a 7-inch. Or it was just like so profoundly sweet and encouraging. And I didn't even care that Alternative Tentacles wasn't going to, you know, listen to my demo anymore. I could not believe my luck.
Yeah.
That Jello Biafra himself took the time to write me a letter. I was overjoyed.
Yeah.
I mean, elated. I 100% elated and framed it, you know, with a professional prayer. It's on my wall.
That's amazing.
It's like the most thrilling thing. But that's a perfect example. Again, West Coast, San Francisco, Alternative Tentacles were doing stuff that no one else was doing.
Well, and it's funny because, well, it's not funny, but you did. You know, you stuck with it, and you didn't just release a 7-inch. You, like, changed the Canadian music industry.
God bless
right?
you.
Like, you
God
gave,
bless.
You, you know, you gave people, like, my wife's testament to that. Like, a whole generation of women now had someone to look up to.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing to me, because now I think, and at the time, I looked up to all these guys we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Chai Pig and all these sorts
my
of
hero.
People. But, like, you,
still,
you
yeah.
provided another way for women to look.
Amazing. Too. That's incredible to me, because I just look, you know, because I still think I'm 24.
Because mm-hmm.
that doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember turning 30 and saying to my mother on the phone, I feel exactly like I'm 26, Mom. And she said, imagine being my age. Because that never changes. You
no.
always feel that way.
No, yeah, you don't age.
That's horrifying, actually.
Yeah.
But, But yeah, it's fun. Life is too fun not to live it.
Yeah.
And same with music and same with touring in bands. I never get sick of it. I never tire of it. I used to think, well, you know, I want to do something else. But honestly, I just have way too much fun playing shows.
Yeah. And it's you know, it's still impactful. And it's amazing the career you've had, right? Like, I remember, how did Gorilla Gorilla get a video? Because you had just a tape, right? You just shoot like a video on a camcorder? I think that someone probably,
yeah, I can't really remember. I think someone shot it or put it together, like, after the fact. Like,
okay.
Yeah.
Was it after the fact, or was it during the band?
Well, I think we were still, the footage was always when we were a band. But okay. Yeah, I can't actually remember.
Okay. So you were like, because it was so wild to get national airplay as, like, just, like, submitting a video.
Amazing.
You're like, that wouldn't happen now. Like, I can't imagine, like...
now you can't even get an artist on the radio.
Yeah.
And also, radio is a perfect example. I mean, you know, I hope you get syndicated on radio.
We're on, like, iHeartRadio, things like
fantastic.
That. Like, all those sorts
fantastic.
Of, you know, streaming services. But once again, right. I'm like, I'm providing something for free. So, of course, right. they're going to take it. Right. You know, I'm sure if Absolutely. I was asking for money, it might be a different conversation.
Well, it's just, you know, now it's very, very difficult to get an unknown yeah. artist on the radio.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
They have to rely on Spotify and SoundCloud and Bandcamp and all these things. And, you know, it's so saturated.
Mm-hmm.
It would be very, very difficult to get any artist. But you look at these big pop bands and they feature vocalists all the time. And that's how a lot of these, you know, vocalists can break out and stuff. But yeah, it's very daunting. It would be very daunting now.
It's funny when you look at some artists and you're like, oh, I've never heard of this person. Then you're like, 17 billion plays.
That's
like,
right.
It's like, wow, this is... And it's something that's completely ignored by the mainstream.
Yes.
And here's someone that's found the way to break through and just get to that audience and build that audience themselves. And it's
yeah.
like, that side is that punk rock thing kind of like made real where, like, you know, a band just making a tape,
yeah.
touring six times across Canada for some reason.
Yeah.
It's now you could break through and get to that audience and find that audience
oh,
without
definitely.
Having to do that.
But now gas is cost so much
costs
money.
Costs way more. So, yeah.
You know, so it's like, how do you get the band from, say they get a community center show in Brandon and they can play Winnipeg. Yeah, you could probably try and get them to Thunder Bay, but to get them from Thunder Bay to Toronto is like... daunting.
Oh, it's daunting, yeah.
You know, so can you put them through the States and play every little, you know, small high school gym? No, they probably won't get accepted into the States to begin with because of the cannabis laws in Canada.
Yo, you need the visas.
Yeah. It's so hard now. And I get asked for advice all the time from young bands, and I only say two words. Never quit.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you're going to make it. Never stop doing what you're doing, no mm-hmm. matter what. Don't care. Go get jobs. Go to university in between. Doesn't matter. Just never stop. You know, eventually, you just gotta, like, you gotta believe that eventually you're gonna find your audience and it's gonna be just, like, awesome.
Mm-hmm.
It's gonna be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And carve your own lane.
Yes.
Right? Like, I think that's the thing that you did, too. Like, I think it's just... don't try and be anyone else. Be yourself and
yes.
you'll find your audience.
Yes. And don't worry about... what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. Stay in your lane. You know, someone's doing that. They're in their lane. It's cool. Let them do it. You know, that's great. That's fantastic. It has nothing to do with what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, I think people get caught up in that a lot and they become, they feel defeated. It's easy in this world for young artists to feel defeated out of the gate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember reading in a Vice piece about you from like a few years back that you practiced with a Screeching Weasel song or recorded a Screeching
oh my God,
Weasel song.
That's one of my favorite bands.
Really?
Oh yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about Screeching Weasel.
They had this song
Weasel.
That goes, "You love alcohol, don't want to know from nothing else. Can't have a good time without a personality from a bottle. Leave me alone. Don't want to hear your voice." Oh yeah, just like. Like it was yesterday.
That's awesome.
Yeah, great song.
I've had almost every single member on the show now.
Come on.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Amazing. That is too funny. That is wild.
Gorilla Gorilla did a Screeching Weasel song. I think of so many songs that would be so great to cover all the time. Just, you know, because when you're a musician, you're fans of everybody else too.
Yeah.
We used to do a Mastodon cover.
Really?
From their Leviathan album, Blood and Thunder, where it would be a medley in between. This is on my solo project. And this was like, I don't know how many back-to-back tours of America we were on. So it was like, you know, right at that, by that point, it's like jail.
Yeah.
You know, society yes. is like jail. Yeah. There's no rules. It's just like, it's anarchy. Let's
survive.
Yeah. And it's, everything's funny.
Yeah.
You know, this is past, way past bus fever. Bus yeah. fever happened. The tears, the fighting, that's done. Now it's just like nuts. Now yeah. it's just like French fries every day. Just nuts. And we used to stop in the middle of the set, and Scott Cook was the bass player, and they would put his 5-string fretless bass on me. Not plugging it, of course. Trust me, you don't ever want it plugged in. And we would do this medley that included Blood and Thunder by Leviathan.
That's awesome.
And it was just like, and I would like air guitar the bass part. And it was, but also there would also be bass playing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was like, I mean, it was stupid. It was so much fun.
You should do an all punk metal covers record.
From your mouth to God's ears.
That would be amazing.
I think it would be a lot of fun.
Oh, it would be amazing to hear you do that. I also think
All the Time in Canada needs a super group.
Yeah.
Of like cool people.
Yeah.
You know, of our generation, super group, and do a big tour.
That'd be awesome. That yeah. is awesome.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, as I say, like, I've kept you for a while now, but I still, is there a couple more questions?
That sure.
Cool? Okay, because, like, I don't want to keep you all day.
That's okay.
But I was wondering, like, when that first tour happened across Canada, what was that like touring at that point? Like, what were the shows like you're playing with? Who were the bands? Did you ever go out with any other bands?
We did. And the first tour I ever did in Canada was Why I Quit University, much to my parents' chagrin. And we were offered a tour with the Wongs.
Okay.
So Chai yeah. Pig did the Wongs on one of his SNFU hiatuses. And basically, you know, I used to say I learned everything that I ever needed to know about being a front man, because I was a female front man, that's mm-hmm. how I identified at the time. I wasn't a chick singer, I was a female front man. Everything I ever wanted to know or do or learn was from Chai Pig.
Yeah.
In 1990 was this tour, and it was across Canada. And it was great, fantastic, all the same rooms that anyone would play now.
Yeah.
You know? Crocs and Rolls in Thunder Bay. You know, back then I think it was still Fafoun Electrique. I mean, just like, I think at the time it was Barrymore's in Ottawa. Like, I mean, it was just insanity.
Yeah.
These fantastic shows. I had to learn to sing with no monitors. You know, I never asked the sound man or monitor person ever to turn me up because A, I was a girl, so I didn't want to talk very much. Mm. You know, I didn't want to be misinterpreted. And literally, my feeling as a 19-year-old performer was, if I talk to the monitor man, he's going to think I'm hitting on him. Or I don't want him to think that I'm trying to talk to him as an excuse to talk. Like, literally, I was like, yeah, I'm not going to say anything. So, learned to sing from the mains,
mm-hmm.
which I still do. I still can't wear in-ears.
Wow.
Because it's just awkward. It's weird.
Yeah.
I learned how to sing from the mains. And most of these, like, you know, shit little clubs, half of the monitors were blown.
Yeah.
Plus, I played with a lot of guitar players who really only wanted to hear very loud guitar
mm-hmm.
and no vocal on mm-hmm. the stage. And so I had to learn to try and hear myself over all this wall of guitars all the time. And I now... As an adult, even though I was 19, now as an adult, I look back at that first tour, and I feel like all of those lessons I learned, I still have and carry with me as a vocalist. Chai Pig used to drink this, Ninjom cough syrup. Don't get me wrong, kids. There was no drugs in this or codeine or anything.
Okay, but yeah.
Because for singer's throat.
For a codeine
and also
throat.
Like slippery elm bark tea mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I never would have known that. Sure, nowadays, any young singer can probably Google it.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, it was really, you know, he's not necessarily, he's not known to be a warm and friendly person all of the time. Certainly not for a young female singer like myself. And I felt very, very special to be kind of learning these lessons from him. You know, he was basically, he was my Buddha,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, and I was the student, and I still hold him in that high regard, and I still think of those lessons that I learned. I carried them with me.
Well, and he's one of the greatest front people of all time.
It's insanity to me.
Yeah.
You know, how amazing he is.
Yeah. Like, and it's, yeah. I got to see him a few years after that, but even, you know, like, into this day, like, he's still yeah. one of the great front people of all time.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, like, if you're going to university for learning how to be a front person, I guess there's few greater professors to have.
Like, yeah, he was a great, he was just fantastic. And my first tour of Europe, we toured with Life of Agony.
Really?
As my first tour. So it was 10 weeks opening for Life of Agony.
Is this with Biff Naked?
Oh, yeah. And believe me, the Life of Agony at the time was on River Runs Red, yeah, on Roadrunner Records. The audience did not want to hear Daddy's Getting Married, I assure you. 100%. They did not. They were really not concerned,
yeah,
that my daddy was getting married. No. So having beer steins thrown at my head, having, you know, the promoters deem that the catering room was going to be for the headliner, and that we had to like stay outside until our set time, and then go back outside literally for some of these shows. And I remember thinking at that time, because it sucked.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, I'm learning from this. I'm never going to forget these. And it's not like that I'm going to hold it and be resentful. I'm going to learn how to be able to still be positive, still be polite to the headliner, because mm-hmm. that's the whole point. And to still go and have the best show I can have. Even if I have to dodge beer bottles, which I did a lot. And it was, you know, I still look back at it and go, all I can remember in Zurich was the beer bottles being thrown at us, and the chocolates were so good. That's, like, I literally think the snacks were so good.
The positive.
Unbelievable, you know? The promoter's mother in every town used to make the food. The only funny part was I was probably always the only vegan.
Yeah.
And I never really cared what anybody else did or ate, because, again, I was in my lane. That's all I had to worry about. But I assure you, it was boiled meat and beer and dumplings most of the time, if they were lucky. And I literally just got used to not ever eating anything. So I was anorexic for probably, I'm going to guess, about 20 years. Because I just learned to just scrape by and not worry about it. And again, I didn't want to go out of my way to say anything. Mm-hmm. And so, like, now I look at it and go, I'm still the same way, but now I know to bring my own popcorn maker.
Yeah.
You know, like, stupid yeah. stuff. But all those early tours, I learned so much from. And Life of Agony is still one of my favorite bands.
So you were straight edge and vegan your whole life?
No or? Way, Jose. No. I was at first Chrome Dog tour, I would lose my voice every show.
Yeah.
Because when I had a tablespoon of beer, I started talking and talking and talking and talking and laughing and scream laughing. And so I knew that I had to come to a decision where I could either really take it seriously and not drink any alcohol. Plus, I didn't want to wake up with anybody. Mm-hmm. And that was always my fear. You know, if that happens to you as a teenager, you know, you try and mitigate that happening again. And just, again, it was about being a professional and not being misinterpreted. So I just thought, I can't drink. Tri Pig at the time was kind of straight edge, kind of.
Oh,
yes.
Really?
Well, yes, when I first toured
wow,
with him.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and he told me all about that. And he introduced me to Gail Greenwood, who was from Belly and Boneyard before Belly, and at the time was just getting into L7.
Yeah.
And Gail had been straight edge her whole life. And so she and I became pen pals. And then, you know, we became friends over the years. Eventually, I dragged her into my band for a couple tours and whatnot. But she was definitely my, you know, greatest mentor in straight edge life. I just, you know, I just was never really good at alcohol. I would lose my voice, literally. And so I was like, yeah, I can't really do it. Or wake up in, like, married or in jail or yeah. in Italy. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. No reason to go near it then.
It just wasn't for me. And I never smoked pot anyway because I fell asleep. So I never understood pot. I just fell asleep. So, yeah, straight edge was really kind of simple. For me, it was a no-brainer because it was just all about work. But, you know, wherever we went, then there was the whole straight edge scene in punk that was totally militant, different thing.
Yeah.
And when we would play in the States, it was different. The rules were different in every state. And, you know, there were straight edgers that said you can't be in a band with other people who smoke cigarettes or drink alcohol if you're straight edge. I'm like,
that's a pretty militant
rule. Oh, yeah, whatever. See ya. Because it just didn't work in my world.
Yeah.
I was the only, you know, person who didn't. But why should I tell my band they can't get all the beer possible, mm-hmm. you know, so that they still enjoy life and do what they like to do? Anyway, it was great fun.
What about being vegan? Because you would have been, you know, have you been vegan for...
I was a vegetarian for a long time, but I never really ate cheese anyway, because yeah. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Cheese World. It's constipating, in case you hadn't noticed. So I was like, you know, I didn't want to be constipated.
Yeah.
Literally, that was part of my thing. I wouldn't eat anything that would bother my stomach. And that's kind of how it evolved. And then just as my own maturity happened, becoming an adult, becoming an activist, understanding more about the connection with factory farming and whatnot, it was easy to be a vegan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and now I just look at people and I go, wow, it's so easy for you.
Yeah, but those first tours of Europe, it's not like now, right?
Well, no, first tours of Europe, you're lucky to find an apple.
Yeah, like it definitely, there's vegan options in most restaurants now, or, you know.
I always ate in Italian restaurants.
Yeah.
Because I could always get a salad and ensalada verde, you're done.
Yeah.
Or I could get plain noodles with nothing on it. And, you know, or you could get white rice in a Chinese restaurant anywhere in the world and I'd be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally, you know, worst case scenario, I can eat rice and I can eat plain pasta.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Done.
So on the early Biff Naked tours, where, like, you're on tour with Life of Agony, like, where did they, were they trying to put you towards a metal world? Like, because once again, you carve your own lane ultimately.
It's so funny. It was so weird. I had to create my own record label because in Canada, the company that made my first record folded. And the company that distributed them, A&M, didn't want to pick up Biff Naked for A&M. They're like, yeah, this girl will never get on the radio.
Who was on your first label? Who was your first label?
Oh, so Her Royal Majesty's Records was a company I formed with my manager,
okay,
Peter. And in the States, John Zazula was my manager with Marsha Zazula. And so what we did was we licensed it to whoever would have it. And in Germany, on my first record, Edel Records licensed it. They were a dance label. And they brought me over to Germany and threw me on because Adol and Roadrunner were like, you know,
involved.
Fine brothers.
Yeah.
And so they put me on that tour. And it was just like, it was amazing. You know, it was just amazing. We were very, very fortunate. Our team from Adol moved over to Epic.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we toured with a lot of German artists in Germany. That was our base. And then the UK and, I mean, doing Rock'em Park and some of these amazing festivals was, man, that was fun. Good snacks. Good snacks there, boy. Wow.
Yeah, a lot different than the North American touring experience.
So different.
So, you know, different. Yeah.
Really different.
Yeah.
But loads of fun.
Yeah, definitely.
So much fun.
This has been amazing. Would you come back for a part two at some point?
I would love to.
This has been a lot of fun.
I would love to.
And anytime you want to talk about punk rock or hardcore, we didn't even talk about Beyond Possession.
Oh my God, we need to talk about Beyond Possession. And we also need to start talking, we need to talk about Krishna Kaur.
Oh,
and where those guys are right now, because those guys are all my mentors in yoga.
Oh, okay. Well, Youth of the Day is on a West Coast tour this weekend.
Oh, yes.
And stuff. So
it's crazy. It's amazing. Like, honestly, they're just like, now I feel like those bands are more popular than ever.
I think so. I think there's definitely, and it's like, it's once again like Gorilla Gorilla. It's amazing how these bands that, you know, at the time played to small rooms ended up influencing stadiums full of people.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's amazing. Just like, look at how many people know, for example, Waiting Room.
Yeah.
By Fugazi. Everyone in the entire universe knows this song.
Yeah.
They might not know the politics. They might not know how Fugazi got in there. But they know the song.
You just hear it. You just kind of know it, even everybody your first time here.
And everybody sings it.
Did you go to that Cro-Mag show when they played Winnipeg?
No.
Okay. Because there was an infamous bootleg of that show.
No, I was not there.
Okay.
No, but I know the bootleg.
And it's a very, I think I have it in one of these stacks here.
Amazing.
But Biff, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Biff, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Biff will be back for a part two. It was super awesome. That was wicked. Biff came over, and of course, her husband and guitar player and bandmate Snake came over, and we hung out, and we talked music, talked wrestling, and it was, Biff Naked. How sick is that? A legit Canadian icon. And Biff has brand new music coming out, Hotbox Girls, and another single and a new album dropping in the near future. So, yeah, as I say, a legit Canadian music icon. If you want a great book to read, her autobiography is incredible. It details this epic journey throughout music that she undertook, also her battle with cancer and just so much. It's such an inspiring book. It's like a truly inspiring book. You heard her. you heard her talk on this thing. Like, how could you not want to spend more time with Biff? Biff is, oh, I love this. I love doing this podcast for stuff like that. Okay. Now, we got to keep it going, right? Next week on the show, we're gonna roll on into another one that I'm super stoked for you to hear. Alex Ross Perry is on the show. Alex Ross Perry is, of course, the director of The Smell of Her and also other movies as well. Someone who grew up in punk rock, but also someone that worked at a video store. Not just any video store, the legendary Kim's Video in New York. And, I'm stoked for you to hear this one next week on the show. Until then, or next episode on the show, because, you know, this thing comes out at all weird times. So, next episode of the show, which will be coming real soon. But until then, go out there, sign your organ donor cards, create your own culture, and stay safe. And I will see you next week. Thank you for listening. Biff naked on the show. How sick was that?